and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, Michael Ian Black of Stella, Wet Hot American Summer, The State. More on that in a second. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at turnoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on various forms of social media at Left for Damien. If you would like to get in touch with me on Facebook, the best way to do that is by heading over to the Turn Out of Punk Facebook page run by my brother and show producer and Michael Ian Black guest suggester, Tristan Abraham. You can get in touch with him. He can get in touch with me. If you don't use Facebook and you want to see some of the cool stuff that we post on the Facebook page, we also post it over on a Tumblr page. It's turnoutapunk.tumblr.com. And if you'd like to support this show, the best way for you to do that is by subscribing to it on iTunes, writing a review, and rating it. Thank you, everyone that's been rating this thing. Really appreciate it. And if you don't use iTunes and you want to support this thing, you can. I'm sure you can like it on whatever platform you listen to it. Thanks for doing that. And just tell your friends. Let everyone know that you are listening to this podcast and there's something worth checking out over here at Turned Out of Punk. If you subscribe to this podcast, you'll see there's a bunch of other podcasts in that feed. There's Turned Out of Punk Footnotes, hosted by myself and Chris O'Toole, with regular contributors, the Daves. And we cover all sorts of, you know, the spillage, the fallout from Turned Out of Punk. We clean that up in Turned Out of Punk Footnotes. And you will also see that there is a podcast called Oil and Flowers, hosted by Buddha Blaze and myself. And each week we talk about the comings and goings in cannabis, mainly Canadian cannabis, but that's not every week. We do that every few weeks. So check out those two podcasts while you're on the iTunes feed. This show would not be possible in any way without the loving support of the fine folks at Vans. They just came aboard, gave me money so I don't have to spend money to do this thing anymore. But also, I don't have to book anyone that I don't want to book. I don't have to, I just do what I want over here. And they just support me. They said, just keep doing your podcast. And that's what I'm doing. So thank you very much, Vans. On to today's show. Today on the show, we got a big one on this one. This is Michael Ian Black. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Michael Ian Black, he is a well-known, most recently political pundit through social media. He's also a writer, a hilarious, hilarious comedian who's been in a lot of stuff that I love, an actor. Reno 9-1-2, as I mentioned off the top, Wet Hot American Summer. But in his book, in his biography, his autobiography, he mentions that he lost his hearing while playing in a punk band, or he damaged his hearing, I should say, while playing in a punk band. And this thing has always kind of stuck in the back of my mind. It's also stuck in the back of my brother's mind. So, Tristan came up with a list of people he wants on the show, sent it to Brian Schwartz, who works with me, and Brian, I love you, Brian. I love you, Brian. Reached out and made this happen. So today on the show, we have Michael Ian Black to confirm that, yes, indeed, he is a hardcore kid. I also remember seeing a tweet a few years ago where he mentioned Nate from Ensign and retweeted something when Nate was going through battling cancer, which he was able to overcome. So shout out to Nate. But that always stuck in my mind, like, what's the connection to Ensign with this guy? And, well, you're going to hear it all. This is an awesome one. This is a really fun episode. We get into a lot of great territory, a lot of really cool territory. We talk about some of yours are my favorite bands, and this is something I never thought I would do with anyone from The State or Stella or anything. And from the sounds of it, probably the only person I could do this with from The State and Stella, Wet Hot American Summer and everything like that. But I'm not going to ramble on anymore. This is an awesome one. Please sit back, relax, get your mind ready for Michael Ian Black on Turned Out of Punk. Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, man.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I'm a I'm a pretty big fan, like a longtime fan, like ordered the Stella DVD off the internet back in the day kind of fan. And I had state bootlegs kind of fan. And I had no idea.
That's pretty punk rock of you.
Well, I tell you, tape trading comedy tapes. Like, that was something you kind of had to do for a period in the late 90s, early 2000s to get stuff like The State, Mr. Show. Like, a lot of that stuff was kind of like, it hadn't been reissued. So it was like, get a life. You know, you were tape trading in the same way you would for punk stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's right.
But this is a big thrill for me to have you on the show. Big fan of you. Finding out that you were into punk, but I got to start this off the way I start them all off, which is, Michael, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yes. Yes. And I'm not sure that this even qualifies as punk by the time I got into them, but it definitely did for me. Mm-hmm. At the time, and this is in the mid-1980s in suburban New Jersey, which, incidentally, New Jersey had a thriving punk scene, although I didn't know it. I was interested in music, but didn't know how to gain exposure to new music. And so the only thing I had was Rolling Stone magazine. And every issue of Rolling Stone magazine, they would review albums. Mm-hmm. And I distinctly remember reading the review to Husker Du's Candy Apple Gray. Mm-hmm. And that was the album that marked their transition from SST Records to Warner Brothers. It was a major label for them, and they'd come from this DIY indie world.
Finishing up on SST, coming over to Warner Brothers at that point.
And the review, I think, I don't even remember whether they even liked the thing or not. But I was interested. I think if my memory of the review is correct, it was something along the lines of, they still have their bite, but you know, there's also this softer thing, and I don't know that this is going to work out. And you know, essentially, fuck those guys for selling out a little bit.
But amazing, coming from Rolling Stone too.
I know. I might be totally mischaracterizing it. I don't want to slam Rolling Stone.
I'm going with your legend.
Yeah, go with the legend.
Go with the legend.
So I was interested enough and intrigued enough that I bought the cassette. I don't remember where or how, but I bought the cassette, and the very first sound on Candy Apple Gray is essentially static. It's got this very sort of staticky opening. And when I remember putting it into my tape recorder or my boombox for the first time, and I thought, oh, they sold me a bum cassette. Like, it's clearly, this is not meant to be on the album because this is just noise. And I was pretty pissed off about it. And then the static kind of fades out, and it goes into their first song, and it was faster than anything I'd ever really heard, and it had a kind of aggression that I'd never really heard, and I hated it. I really hated it. And so much so that I brought it over to my best friend's house, and I was like, you really need to listen to how terrible this is. This is like the worst thing I've ever heard. And we played it. And then somewhere in there, it dawned on me that this was kind of amazing and that I actually loved it. I don't know how many plays it took, but for some reason I kept going back to it. I was like, let me just return to this and see if I can make heads or tails of it.
It was a grower of a record.
It was what?
It was a grower of a record. It had to grow.
It was a grower, not a shower. That's
exactly
right.
Exactly.
And that set me off on that whole world. That album opened up just a huge world for me.
So had you kind of, before, you know, stumbling upon this Rolling Stone review, where were your kind of musical tastes at that point?
Well, I don't know that I had any. Mm-hmm. I mean, I liked pop. I liked things that were on MTV. Mm-hmm. But I remember feeling like And I am by no means cutting the legs out from Duran Duran or Wham, whom I still adore.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking there must be more. I mean, I had that feeling. There just has to be more. And so at a similar time, Rolling Stone reviewed a Philip Glass album. And I was like, well, I'll buy that. And that didn't work out for me as well as the Husker Du. Although now I listen to far more Philip Glass than I do Husker Du.
Well, where do you rate Candy Apple Grey now, like in the Husker Du oeuvre? Because as you say, that's a controversial record. I think it's one of their best, but
oh, it's in the Husker Du. Well, I mean, it has. I have a lot of sentiment towards it, mm-hmm. so it's probably my favorite. I mean, I just love it. Mm-hmm. I love it pretty much from start to finish. And then Warehouse Songs and Stories came out a couple years. Maybe a year or two after that, which is their final double album.
Yeah.
And that's got some amazing stuff on it too, but it's not as consistently great. And then, you know, I got into Flip Your Wig and Zen Arcade and all of that stuff. But Candy Apple Grey was really just kind of, it was my Sgt. Pepper's. It just sort of opened a door in my head, that made me go, oh, you can do this with music. And it's also got like some really sort of, it's got at least one or two really sort of softer melodic things on it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand that you could juxtapose those two ideas in the same kind of album. I thought based on Wham and Duran Duran that you had a sound and that sound had to be consistent from, you know, your three hits through all your filler. and that was how you made a record album.
Yeah, they're really the pioneers of that loud, soft dynamic that becomes like the basis of, I guess, the grunge stuff that would get popular a few years later.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So where did you kind of go from here? You've got this, you know, this record that's grown on you. Was it just, you know, kind of picking up bits and pieces after that? Were you trying to go to shows or where did you kind of?
I definitely discovered. So through Husker Du, you know, started just finding things. Mm-hmm. And my chief way of finding things was to go to the Princeton Record Exchange, which was about half an hour, 40 minutes from my house. A legendary store in Princeton, New Jersey. And looking essentially for albums whose cover art scared me, or the name of the band made me laugh or shocked me. So I remember looking at like Black Flag albums and being like, oh, that's really terrifying. Like their cover art, for whatever reason, I found really scary. Simultaneous with that, you know, there'd be a band called the Circle Jerks, and I'd be like, oh, well, I should probably check out the Circle Jerks because that's an amazing name.
Yep.
And then sometimes this could backfire. So I bought 10,000 Maniacs thinking that's an amazing
thing. Yeah, that would be a bit of a bummer.
It wasn't at all what I had anticipated.
No. were you kind of like, when you're going to the Princeton Record Exchange, were you talking to the clerks there, or is it just
no.
kind of like?
No, terrified to talk to the clerks because they knew everything. I mean, they were gods. And so there was no, I didn't feel worthy of talking to them. And I felt like they would just laugh at me. I mean, I was a high school kid.
Yeah.
And they were Princeton Record Exchange employees. and you know, it was like walking into one of those indie video stores or something that existed at the time where, you know, they were just filled with film snobs.
Yep.
And they were probably just very nice kids, only a few years older than myself, who just knew more about music, but I was way too intimidated to talk to anybody about music.
It's funny because there's an author who's been on this show before, Tony Rettman, and mm-hmm. his brother was one of the notorious Princeton Record Exchange clerks for years and years and years and years. So wow. He had to live with that at home every day.
I'm a little bit starstruck just hearing about it.
I tell you, I get the big names on this show, Michael. Like, I'm not just reaching out of here as, you know.
No, you got the names. Brother of a Princeton Record Exchange employee. I'm blown away.
I'm saying, I'm telling you, I got connections in this world. As far as like, you know, local music, you mentioned that New Jersey scene, which is, you know, yeah, in the mid 80s, there's a lot of stuff happening. Were you picking up on any of that? Were there other kids in your high school that were kind of into this stuff too?
Well, eventually what happened was when I became a senior in high school and I was young, I probably just turned 16. My friend and I had a friend named Tim, and Tim was into punk in a way that I wasn't. He was like a skateboarder, and he, you know, would have a mohawk, and he just kind of exuded a punk vibe that I desperately wanted to exude but didn't.
Did Tim play any bands or anything?
Well, he and I decided to start a band.
Oh, okay. Oh, yes.
And so we recruited a couple other guys, and we started a punk band. And it was in that, in starting that, that I really became aware of the New Jersey scene and the whole, there was, you know, a New York hardcore scene and a New Jersey hardcore scene. And we, you know, we never really did much with it. I mean, we played, but it was sort of just being immersed in a band and sort of paying attention to kind of zines or shows that were going on locally, that I became really hyper aware that there was a distinct New Jersey / New York, I mean more New York / New Jersey, to be honest, hardcore scene that I desperately wanted to absorb and learn about. So there were bands, I mean the big like New York hardcore band, I think was probably the Cro-Mags, who I found utterly terrifying. I mean, there were so many, and I think they kind of legit were terrifying, sick of it all. They were like serious, like assholes.
Well, like, it's funny because like the time that scene was, there was a lot of issues with violence and stuff. I'm sure as a young person going to those shows must've been a hairy
proposition. Well, yeah. So it was in Trenton, but our big club was City Gardens, in South Jersey, and we would go there fairly regularly. And the idea of entering one of those mosh pits was so intimidating. I mean, I never did it. It was a place where you could easily, if you went into the mosh pit, you would expect to be hurt, physically hurt.
Yeah.
And it felt like there was a fair chance that you might get assaulted, like actually beat up, because skinheads would hang out, like white supremacist skinheads would hang out there, and then they would be sort of spoiling for a fight with just sort of the run of the mill mohawk punks and skate punks, and then you would have the like straight edge punks, and everybody was kind of there to see the music, but also be part of this scene, and also to stir up trouble, and also to slam dance. And so it was just a very combustible mix, and it was fascinating and terrifying to be there.
Do you remember the very first punk show you went to?
No, I don't know that I could put them in order. I remember seeing the Ramones there. I remember, like, the thing is, you would go to City Gardens because whatever was at City Gardens was going to be cool.
Yeah.
So I would see bands whose names I don't know who they were. Yeah. I have no idea. they were bands, and that's kind of all that mattered.
What about AOD or any of those Buy Our Records bands? Were you into that stuff?
Oh, did I ever see AOD? I don't think so. I probably would remember if I had. Probably not. God, I wish I mean, I can remember bands that I saw, but I don't know specifically at City Gardens.
Oh, yeah, just anywhere. Any shows that you kind of stand out
to? Oh, I'm almost sure I saw Circle Jerks. I saw The Descendants. I saw The Descendant of The Descendants all. I saw Fugazi. I saw, God, I don't even know. And then just so many just like local shows. Just local Jersey shows.
So what kind of sound were you gravitating more? Like, obviously The Descendants, you know, it's on the poppier side.
Right.
Was it that kind of like the stuff that had that melodic edge that was more appealing to you at the time?
Yeah. Eventually, you know, at that time, there was a real kind of split, and I get, you know, it still exists, but it's much less defined now, between metal and punk. But there was an increasing amount of blurring of those edges. So bands like Suicidal Tendencies or oh God, who's the other one I'm thinking of? They never made it big, but DRI?
Yeah, DRI. They definitely, the crossover band that yeah. put out the record crossover.
Anthrax. There was this whole kind of crossover thing happening, and I was very wary of anything that smelled like metal. because hair bands and that kind of like pop metal thing was so, I mean, yeah, pop metal thing was so kind of like prevalent in New Jersey and so popular. And the kids who liked that shit, I didn't like those kids.
Yeah.
So anything that had guitar solos, anything that had hair, anything that had just that kind of that metally, very technical music, I just sort of instinctively rejected.
Yeah. It was Trans Am rock, right? It was like that was the music of the enemy too. So I imagine when it started crossing over, it got weird.
It got very weird. And then what happened in 1980, I don't know when these two albums came out, mm-hmm. but it felt like to me when they happened that they were setting the stage for, like you said, for grunge, but Appetite for Destruction and Nothing Shocking came out roughly the same time. Obviously both huge albums.
Yeah.
But I felt like, I mean, I really distinctly remember like kind of talking about this and analyzing this with my friends. Like Appetite for Destruction was coming at something from the metal side that was the same kind of thing that Jane's Addiction was coming at from the punk side. They had very different sounds, but it felt like to me the attitude of what they were doing was similar. And it felt like it was all kind of setting the table for the grunge movement that happened a couple years after that. It was a kind of rejection of the sort of pop status quo and trying to find new ways to take those worlds and make them into something more commercial. And that idea that sort of you could change music, I didn't, or you could change sort of the popular idea of what music could be, was really kind of fascinating to me that you could watch that happen in real time.
Yeah. It's funny, 'cause I don't think I've ever thought of those two records as being, you know, similar in a lot of ways, but you're right. They are kind of like bookends of this sort of like push.
To me, the thing that like Axl Rose to me was a very different front man, and that band was a very different kind of band than what immediately preceded them in terms of what was big. Mm-hmm. They definitely had a kind of dangerous punk vibe to them, but they were coming at it from metal. And Jane's Addiction, I think, had a similar thing. I mean, it's more art rocky, I guess, than punk, but I sense that they were trying to find a similar space. Coming at it from, I'm going to call it the left rather than Guns N' Roses, who I felt like were coming at it from the right. I don't know. One man's theory.
No. And I think it holds water too. And I think it's also when you think like, you know, Duff McKagan in Guns N' Roses had played in all these punk bands in the Pacific Northwest. So it's almost like both mm-hmm. of these albums are kind of coming out of the wreckage that was the first punk explosion and sort of setting the table for the next music.
Right. And I felt like simultaneously destroying, at least in terms of Guns N' Roses, kind of what was going on in the hair metal scene. Mm-hmm. It was sort of throwing down a gauntlet and saying, we're better. I mean, Metallica was kind of doing the same thing. Just like, we're better. Fuck you.
Well, and it's funny because like you bring up the, with Axl Rose, like, you know, the toughness and the scariness, but he also had this vulnerability that you don't see in like Robert Plant or, you know, these people that presented themselves as like larger than life rock figures. Like he presented himself. It's kind of like this vulnerable, multifaceted kind of front person that was a break.
That's right. I hadn't thought about that, but I do think that's right. He did have a kind of vulnerability, and maybe that's, maybe that's where I see a lot of the crossover too, because Peripheral, I feel like, had a similar vibe.
Yeah.
Peripheral, in a sense, was more like his vulnerable side was more forward, mm-hmm. but there was also something kind of weird and scary about him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. And it's weird because both those records are coming out of Los Angeles at that exact same time. So, you know what? I think you stumbled on a good one, Michael. This is a new rock theory that I think holds a lot of water. When those records came out, though, at the time, were you into them, or were you still rejecting anything metal?
I rejected out of hand Guns N' Roses, and then I had to – because one of the guys in my band came from the sort of more metal world, our drummer, more from like the Anthrax kind of side of things. But I think he got it right away, and the album was just kind of in rotation in my circle. And I, over a period of not that long, a few weeks maybe, I sort of had to grudgingly admit that I kind of loved this, that I thought it was, and I was intrigued by the different sort of vocal personas that Axl Rose had on one album. Like, yep. There was debate when that came out, whether that was one guy singing or not. In my group of friends, we were like, that can't be one guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, right. It's like it's got like, it's a precursor to screamo, where you have these vocalists that would do these incredibly distinct vocals within the same track. But yeah, he does almost completely different personalities that he expresses in those vocals. At the time, like, were any of the, what kind of bands were you playing with? Like, sonically, like, actually, what did your band sound like?
Well, I mean, we were desperately trying to be a hardcore band.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were 16-year-old twerps. and so we sounded like some 16-year-old New Jersey suburbanites trying to sound like a hardcore band. But I remember I was the front guy, which I really had no business being, although what frontman ever has business being a front guy in punk? I mean, you just sort of have to scream into a microphone. But I developed a kind of very deliberate vocal sound because I felt like my own voice, the way I would normally speak or sing, was just too young sounding. And so I developed this very sort of deep growly thing, or what I thought was deep and growly. And literally every rehearsal and every show, I would lose my voice because it strained so much.
So who were your kind of like vocal icons that you were trying to sound like? Were you trying to sound like a John Brandon from Negative Approach, or?
It was probably more like the Minor Threat guys, you know, probably more like that idea. Just sort of fast and furious and just kind of banging around, making noise. And we didn't have the musicianship and we didn't have any of their skills. But it was sort of like, that was kind of something to aim towards.
Yeah. You're also 16. Like those guys were a little bit older.
Yeah, but not much.
Yeah. But they, I think they had, you know, they had a couple more years to get those chops in. Like hey, what was your band called?
The Pleased. It was meant ironically.
Oh, wait, were you in a band with Nate? Was Nate from Ensign in that band too?
No. From Ensign, Tim Shaw.
Tim Shaw was in?
That's
the Tim you're talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, whoa. That's fucking crazy. That band had a huge role in my, like, growing up.
Oh, really?
Oh, God, yeah. That's Tim, I used to go and see him. I saw him a couple years ago when they came to Toronto and did a reunion. But, yeah, I think they stayed at my friend's house one time and stuff. But what an amazingly small world.
Well, that's what it blew my mind, actually, because I lost touch with Tim for, I don't know, at least 10 years. And then we finally hooked up again in the city. And I couldn't imagine kind of what he was doing with his life, because he wasn't really, it didn't seem like he was well suited to be anything other than a punk rocker. And then it turned out that he was a punk rocker.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
Well, he, cause he actually became the roadie for Sick of It All for a while, right?
Yeah.
Had he started that when you guys were hanging out, or is that still a couple years
ago? No, that was several years down the line.
So it's amazing that he, and I think when he was hanging out with him, it was like a pretty hairy tour. I think things got pretty wild at that point. So what about any of the, like what band, do you remember actually the first show you guys played, like what bands you played with or anything?
No, I mean, we played at a Battle of the Bands, I think was our first thing, like a local Battle of the Bands. And we won it, which I felt very, very good about. And then the next thing we played was like a winter show at our high school. And then we would play, I can't even remember the name of the club, but somehow we got booked at this club that we played a couple times. We played at CBGB's. They had basically like a talent show, essentially. Like you could sign up. Okay. They would call, I think, audition night.
That must have been a huge gig, though, to get to play. You know, that's like legendary hallowed ground.
Oh, it was amazing. It was the highlight of – I mean, it remains one of the highlights of my life.
That's awesome.
Playing at CBs, you know, even though it was literally just calling up and they'd be like, okay, we'll bring 20 people and you can play for 15 minutes on a Monday. You know, it was that sort of shady and dumb.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. There was a band that didn't go anywhere, but just since you asked, there was a band called Rain, R-A-I-N, who we competed against, I feel like, in another Battle of the Bands, and they were also local guys. And I just remember thinking, God, they're so much better than we are. And they were.
I think they might have put out records, actually, Rain, right?
Rain?
Yeah, I think Rain might have done some singles later on, if I'm
– Wait, I'm gonna Google them. I mean, Rain – I'm going to Google Rain Band – New Jersey.
Discogs.
Let me see.
Are you
Discogs?
Are you familiar with the website Discogs?
No.
This is a discography website where almost every record ever is cataloged.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. It's.
But I mean, there's got to be other bands called Rain.
There were a couple others, but I thought there was a Rain from New Jersey that had a couple singles, but maybe
it's possible. It's very possible.
Or maybe I'm thinking of Rain on the Parade. But anyway, I did you guys record?
Yeah, we made a demo. Our drummer, I remember we went to this studio called Skylab, run by this guy named Dan something, and we went to see him, and he's like, I don't remember how much it was to record it, but it was super expensive. It was like $5,000 or something like that. And there's no way we get our hands on that kind of money. Yeah. And our drummer's like, let me see what I can do. And it basically turns out that his dad in New Jersey was in something like the waste removal service.
I understood. I think we've all seen a certain cable TV show and can understand where this is going.
Yeah. Which is to say that he had cash at home.
Yeah.
And John, I think, basically just stole the money from his like mobbed up dad. And we recorded this album.
Oh, that for $5,000 your demo too?
Yeah.
I want to hear this please demo. This is now jumped to the top of my want list. I'm a terrible record collector and tape collector. So I have to track down a copy of this demo.
And it would be impossible to find.
Well, now that's a challenge to throwing down the gauntlet. So would you, what was the kind of hope of this band in your eyes? Like, were you kind of thinking we're just going to do this demo, or did you kind of have sights set on signing a Revelation Records or?
Well, no, we definitely wanted to sign, to somebody. I mean, and we sent it out unsolicited and received no solicitations in return. we actually drove to, oh God, what was the name of that metal label in New Jersey that I feel like Anthrax was actually on?
Combat? At one point.
No.
Megaforce?
Megaforce. We drove to Megaforce.
Oh, that's awesome. And did you get it and just like drop the tape off, or did you kind of try and wait around and talk to A&R?
We dropped the tape off and never heard anything. But the highlight, one of the highlights was we did a cover of If You Leave by OMD. You know, we did like a punk cover of it. And there was this radio show on PRX, which is the Princeton radio station, that featured local bands. And for a few weeks anyway, they would play it. And that was a huge thrill.
Yeah. That's radio airplay. Like, a, you know, how many bands never get a shot of that?
I know.
And so when this, how did this band wrap up? Did you kind of just all hit college or?
Yeah, we hit college, you know, and it was like, there just wasn't a way to keep it going. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we kind of idly thought, well, maybe we'll take a year and just see if we can make something of it. But, I don't think any of it, we were committed to it, but not that committed where we were going to forego college. Yeah. And I'm glad we didn't because we weren't that good. And because I really have no talent in singing. Well, I really have very little ability.
Take it from a guy who's made a 15-year career out of having no talent yelling into a microphone. Don't, you know what? It's all smoke and mirrors. It's definitely, I think you would have been an amazing front person. Did you do banter in between songs, or you guys just kind of trying to be a straight up fast hardcore band?
I don't think we did that much I don't really remember, but I remember going to shows and thinking the front man's talking too much.
Yeah.
Like, and I remember seeing the Ramones and then just going like, they start and then 35 minutes later they're done. And you're like, oh, is that all that is? So I think we were somewhere in the middle, but leaning towards the Ramone side of things.
Given, like, you know, that you've got, obviously in your comedy, a lot of politics gets in there too. Were you into Jello Biafra's spoken word stuff, or is that?
I was into the Dead Kennedys more than I was into Jello. I feel like he wasn't even quite doing the spoken word stuff, or maybe he was just starting then, or at least I was only just becoming aware of it. But yeah, I bought a Dead Kennedy. Like, that was one of the ones that at Princeton Record Exchange, I was like, I saw the Dead Kennedys and I was like, I have to have this.
Yeah.
And yeah, we would, and I think Tim was into the Dead Kennedys too. Maybe he introduced me to them and then I picked it up there. But yeah, and I can't say I liked the Dead Kennedys, but I listened to the Dead Kennedys.
What kind of, like, you know, you mentioned the Descendants, obviously, and Husker Du. What were some of your favorite bands?
At the time, it was weird for me because I would listen almost without discretion. I would listen eventually I got very into Dag Nasty, which is more melodic, like you said, and I really liked Minor Threat, and I liked, oh wow,
what about Youth of the Day? Were you into them at all?
I don't even know Youth of the Day.
Oh, they were like a New York, they were Connecticut kind of straight edge band around 87.
One of the, I'm surprised I don't know them.
I mean, you might have even seen them. One of those.
That's entirely possible. I kind of remember Wasted Youth.
Oh, Wasted Youth.
Yeah, they may have been local.
Oh, the LA band?
I don't know. I don't remember who they were. I just remember kind of being aware of them, and they were sort of like one of these bands that sort of just had a presence.
Yeah.
Wasted Youth was a hardcore. Yeah, from LA.
From LA. Yeah.
So they were not local at all.
And the drummer of that band married Patricia Arquette.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Or they were for at least a while married. It all comes back to Wasted Youth. You know, it's like the Rosetta Stone of culture.
I guess so.
So when you hit university, did your taste begin to change as far as music goes? Or were you still kind of like into this stuff into your university years?
I remained interested and into it for at least a few years. But then, you know, I just got so busy with my life that music kind of fell away a little bit, just the way it does. You know, I think when I was in high school, I felt like that was all I thought about, particularly my last couple of years of high school. And then when I got into college, there was just less of it. My roommate was, not by choice, just a guy that I ended up rooming with, was a huge record collector and really into this whole world. And I think part of the reason I got less into it was because he was like one of those clerks. He was just so into it, and he wasn't a dick about it at all. And he would let me borrow whatever records I wanted to listen to. But it just felt like it was almost like the reason I stopped playing chess. Because I was like, I'll never be a grandmaster, so what's the point? Mm-hmm. That's sort of how it felt like with me and punk and this whole world.
Eventually becomes a battle for knowledge, right? Like it's like a competition.
That's kind of what it felt like.
Yeah.
And so simultaneous with sort of that feeling was the feeling like I started feeling like I'm defining myself in this way. And I don't want to do that in the sense, like, I don't want people to look at me and go, I know who that is because of the way he dresses or because of whatever. It started to feel like a costume I was wearing. Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of set it aside because I didn't want to, it started to feel constraining.
What did your roommate have a band or anything, or was your roommate?
No, he was purely a fan.
Wow. That's some dedication. That sounds like what I would be. Just a record nerd.
Yeah, that's what he was. He was a record nerd.
Were there like a lot of kids in your high school that were into it, or were you guys kind of like
in
a little group?
No, very, very, very few. Yeah. And that's part of what attracted me to it was the elitism of it, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I can relate to that. when did comedy begin to kind of become like one of the main focuses for you? And was that at this kind of the same time? Like, were you an SCTV fan growing up or?
No, I wasn't. SNL. But I didn't really know anything about comedy. It wasn't something that I was particularly interested in other than I liked things that were funny. Mm-hmm. But then freshman year of college, I started this group with these other guys and then it became my life.
Were any of those guys into punk at all?
Yes. Ben Garant, okay, who was in the state, was, his sensibility was more like the Cramps, mm-hmm, and like kind of oddball-y, slightly rockabilly-ish, punkish kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He's from the South. But he was the only guy who I feel like was sort of on my same vibe musically.
Carrie Kenny had she had a cool band, right? Like,
oh, she had a great band. I mean, yeah, eventually she started dating Craig Wedren from Shudder to Think.
Okay.
And after that, Eli Janney from Girls Against Boys. And I think sort of she got really immersed in that scene, mm-hmm, just the kind of music scene. And then she and two friends started this band called Cake Like that really had a nice little run.
Yeah.
I mean, they put out 3 or 4 albums and they were great.
They had a single on Genius Records too. That's mm-hmm, fantastic.
Which one do you remember?
I'm trying to remember. It's like one, I think it's their second single or the first single. That was the only thing I knew. And I had no idea. I never made the connection until someone mm-hmm told me recently. And I'm like, oh my God, what a wild thing to find out.
Yeah. They were great.
Yeah. So what was the music culture around the state? Cause you guys, you know, obviously do stuff with MTV. Was it tied into music at all?
Initially, no. Because it just wasn't. I mean, we were theater kids. Mm-hmm. And so there was music around, but oddly, like the band that probably we were most into as a group, and I wouldn't even say there was a scene around Blues Traveler.
Really?
Yeah.
That was the last. And so, say Pavement. I thought you were going to go a lot of places, Michael, but Blues Traveler was definitely not the place I thought you were going to go. Really?
And it's because Michael Showalter went to high school with some of those guys. And so they were doing these shows and we would just go. And I didn't like them or dislike them. It was just more like the scene. And so through them, it's like we would go to downtown. There was like a Deadhead club called the Wetlands. And the Spin Doctors would play and Blues Traveler would play. And it was like this whole thing. And so it was a very kind of social event. Mm-hmm. So those were like the only bands that, like, as a group, I feel like we would go see. But no, I mean, I would go by myself to see things or with maybe one or two of the guys from from the state. I think I went to see the Sugar Cubes by myself at CB's one night.
So where were your tastes kind of going? Like, you know, obviously fantastic taste right there with the Sugar Cubes, but like, where were you kind of heading music wise personally at that point?
I think I was just sort of moving a little bit all over the map. The same way I think I found Husker Du, I think I was just kind of looking for things. I was looking just for interesting things. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was kind of like whatever was in the air I was interested in.
Jon Stewart hosted that show. You wrote it. You watch it that you guys did mm-hmm. on MTV for a while. Did you know yeah. him from back when he was doing Barback at those shows in New Jersey?
No. I met him through You Wrote It, You Watch It.
Okay. It's amazing to think of like all these interesting people that happened to be in the same room at the same time.
I know. I didn't know that he'd been there until I read about it years later.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you guys talk about music? Was that like a shared thing? Because you're a hardcore kid and that's obviously very different than just being a music fan. Did you feel like any sort of common connection as far as just being part of a broader punk scene with people, or were you kind of viewing your experience as being a different trip?
Well, with John in particular, I don't think I ever really talked to him about music. I don't know. Musically, I felt like I carried this this kind of hardcore chip on my shoulder for years.
Yeah.
Which I think maybe you have to even get into hardcore. and then it was so wrapped up in not just the music, but also again that sense of elitism and almost entitlement of this is something that I have that you could never possibly understand. And it's like just the worst form of musical dickishness. But I was absolutely that guy to a small extent.
I kind of wonder if we do that because like, you know, for whatever reason, either they reject us or we reject the popular kids. So it's almost like, well, you know what? Fuck you. We're going to have something that you can't even get. Like you can't
exactly. It's exactly what it was. It's 100% what it was.
Yeah. Cause what you're saying is I think a very common experience held by every single hardcore kid. Did you ever identify as straight edge?
No, but I didn't drink and I didn't smoke and I definitely identified with them. Mm-hmm. I was kind of right up to the line of it. But there was a militancy about it that I didn't like. And also they were all abstinent. And I was like, I'm not going to fucking – that's the one thing that I really want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those rules that like, you know, it's like one of those variable rules, like no caffeine.
Right.
You know, it's like, wow, you know, like or but no
I really
aspirin.
I admired how committed they were to it.
Yeah. Well, it got and it got even more dogmatic and more extreme as it would go on in the 90s. And you would have like an entire movement, like a hardline movement where, you know, they would be doing actions like, you know, and it would get tied to veganism. And it would get – it's amazing how this sort of like thing that just kind of started out of this song Minor Threat did would become like an ideology that, you know, it's worldwide today. Like, you know, there's kids now that identify as straight edge that have no idea about punk rock.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't know that. I have to run. I'm so sorry.
No, that's great. Thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure, Damien.
And one day I'd love to punish you some more about this stuff, but this has been a great experience.
Oh, cool. I'm so glad. And I really enjoyed talking about it.
Awesome, Michael. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Thank you, Michael, for coming on the show. And though he had to run very quickly there towards the end, it was a little abrupt, but he did say he will be back for a part two. And that will be something I will hold him to because, oh my gosh, there's a lot more to get into. That was so much fun. Once again, thank you to Brian. Thank you to Tristan. Thank you to you for listening. Oof, oof. And you know what? With this podcast, the hits keep on coming because next week on the show, John Reese of Rock from the Crypt, of Drive Like Jehu, of the brand new album releasing Hot Snakes and also from Yo Gabba Gabba. He will be on the show next week. We talk about a lot of stuff. We go deep. We talk about Nemesis Records. We go deep. This is a super fun one. Yeah, there's a lot of cool shit in this one. So that is next week on the show. Yeah. 1 week, I'm talking about Sick of It All and AOD with Michael Ian Black. The next week, I'm going to be talking about Pusshead with John Reese. So until next week, go out there and make your own culture. There's some real cool secrets still hiding out there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I will see you next week. Bye.